This is Victoria, producer for The Felon File, a podcast on law enforcement history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains of the United States and beyond. Listened to in 39 countries around the world. Scott Lunsford hosts The Felon File. Scott is a retired American police sergeant.
The Felon File podcast would like to take a moment to remember North Carolina State Trooper Bobby Lee Coggins. On Saturday, September 14, 1985, Trooper Coggins gave his life in service to his state and community. Trooper Bobby Coggins was shot and killed after stopping two Arkansas prison escapees in a stolen pickup truck near Hot Springs, North Carolina, on State Road 209. He had observed what he suspected to be a possible intoxicated driver. Stopping the vehicle and checking on the occupants, the dispatchers advised that the two were escapees. One of the men then produced and opened fire with a .25 caliber pistol. Trooper Coggins attempted to return fire but did not strike the suspects. The second suspect picked up Trooper Coggins's gun and shot him in the head. Both suspects were arrested 3 days after trackers and a bloodhound named Brandy forced them out of the Blue Ridge Mountains into the hands of waiting agents of the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation. All officers involved in the search and arrest gave credit to Brandy for the arrest. Both 23-year-old suspects were convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life plus 93 years on May 21, 1986. Just minutes before being shot, Coggins' fiancée had driven past the scene where he had just stopped the vehicle with the suspects. Trooper Coggins had served with the North Carolina Highway Patrol for 1 year and was a seasonal park ranger for the National Park Service for the previous 2 years. He is survived by his fiancée, brother, and parents. Rest in peace, sir.
Background and intro music through purpleplanet.com.
Greetings and welcome back to another episode of the Felon File podcast. As Victoria said, I'm your host, Scott Lunsford, retired law enforcement detective sergeant, researcher, writer, wearer of many hats. And today, your host here on the Felon File, where we look at crime, punishment, the good guys, the bad guys, some of the incidents that have happened in the Appalachian Mountains, criminal-wise, as well as elsewhere. And we're coming to you today from the Scratch Ankle International Podcast Recording Studio in Scratch Ankle, North Carolina. West of Asheville, east of Canton, make a left at the light. And once more, we appreciate you tuning in. I think we've got an interesting shade of blue story for you today. One that takes place in a couple of locations. And like I said, we look at not only the Appalachian Mountains, but we go beyond there. And today we're going to Rhode Island. Very cold morning on December 21st, 1832. John Durfee made a horrifying discovery on his father's farm in Triveton, Rhode Island. Hanging by the neck from a cord lashed to a 5-foot haystack post. These posts are used to stack hay against and so that it can dry out. John found the frozen body of 30-year-old Sarah Marie Cornell. Investigators were able to identify the 30-year-old woman. She was a factory worker in Fall River, Massachusetts. The family from whom Sarah rented a room discovered among her personal effects and belongings a note written by Cornell and dated the same day of her death that said, quote, "If I should be missing, inquire of the Reverend Mr. Avery of Bristol. He will know where I am." Now, who is this Avery? Well, it turns out that Ephraim K. Avery He was pretty well known. He was a distinguished married Methodist clergyman living in Bristol, Rhode Island, a minister who was among the first clergymen tried for murder in the United States, apparently. Although there are some other people that claim some other firsts, and we'll get into those possibly in another podcast. Once more, Avery is often said to be cited as the first. Now, other suspicions and incriminating letters also came to light, as well as a conversation the lady had with the doctor indicating that the married Avery was the father of her unborn child. At first, it was believed that she had committed suicide, but later, after the note was discovered, it kind of changed that line of thought. And this began a situation that received national attention and led to one of the longest murder trials in Rhode Island history. And the first clergyman tried for, like I said, for murder in the United States. Avery is often cited to be the first, but more than likely there was another case that did precede this. A coroner's jury was convened as soon as the body was found in Triverton. This is before an autopsy had been performed as well. Now, at the coroner's inquest, it was found, and this is the official findings of that inquest, that the said Sarah M. Cornell was found dead, hung up, and confined with a small cord or rope about her neck to a stake inside of a stackyard. And the jurors do further say that they believe that said Sarah Cornell committed suicide by hanging herself upon a stake in this location and was influenced to commit the crime by the wicked conduct of a married man, which we gather from a Dr. Wilbur, together with contents of three letters found in the trunk of Sarah Cornell by her landlord. This inquest was held before the autopsy. After the autopsy, however, it was discovered that Cornell had been 4 months pregnant at the time of her death. This time in Bristol, Rhode Island, a second coroner's jury was convened. This jury overruled the earlier finding of suicide, and it accused Ephraim Kingsbury Avery, the married Methodist minister, as the principal or accessory in her death. Avery was quickly arrested on a charge of murder, but just as quickly as he was arrested, he was set free. Now, the pregnancy led another minister, a Methodist minister, to reject the responsibility later of burying her a second time. She had already been once buried, but then she was exhumed later for another autopsy. But this was the second time she was to be buried, and that particular Methodist minister refused to oversee the burial, which caused a side distraction into the murder trial. Responsibility for her burial was assumed by the Fall River Congregationalist, and Cornell was buried as an indigent on Christmas Eve. The congregational churches were Protestant churches in the Reformed Calvinist tradition that practice governance in their organization, in which each congregation operated independently and autonomously run their own affairs, in their own business. Now, the people of Falls River collected money. The two communities pledged to assist the officials of Triverton with the murder investigation, and the citizens of Triverton also added to this fund. The next day, a steamship was chartered to take over 100 men from Fall River to Bristol to confront the Methodist minister. These 100 men surrounded Avery's home and demanded that he come out. Avery said no. But he did send a friend of his outside to try to talk and hopefully calm down the crowd. Yeah, that's a good friend. The mob of men finally left when the steamship signaled that it was getting ready to back out and leave and go back upriver. Afraid of losing their ride, the 100 men left. In Bristol, still another inquest was convened. This time, two justices of the peace argued that they found insufficient evidence to try Avery for the murder. Therefore, they were going to release him. As you can guess, that didn't go over too well with the community of Fall River. Rumors started that one of the justices was actually a Methodist congregant looking to quell the scandal. The local deputy sheriff of Fall River, a Mr. Harvey Harnden, well, he decided he was going to take the matter in his own hands, legally, of course, and he obtained from a Rhode Island Superior Court judge a warrant for Avery's arrest. After presenting to the judge, and the judge hearing the evidence, that judge found probable cause and issued the warrant. Now, when the Rhode Island sheriff went to have it served, guess what? Avery was gone. He'd taken off, flown the coop, so to speak. No, to lose all his work on this case and justice for the young lady and her unborn, on January 20th of 1833, the deputy sheriff was able to track Avery to Rhine Ridge, New Hampshire, where Avery claimed he had fled to because he was in fear of his life, especially after the big mob of 100 men showed up and surrounded his house. He ended up being arrested and extradited back to Newport, Rhode Island, where Avery was put in jail. On March 8, 1833, he was indicted for murder by a Newport, Rhode Island County grand jury. He pled not guilty to all the charges, and ended up a trial was to be set. Now, there were several points of interest in the death of this young girl, not just to the church's interest. Another issue was New England Protestantism was suspicious of the encroachment of the comparatively new sect of Methodism, and the trial seemed to confirm their worst fear. She had also been employed, like I said, at the Fall River manufacturing mill, the 19th century American industrial, whose cotton mills relied on labor from the young, newly independent women. They were kind of concerned, not just for the loss of the life of a young girl, but they saw it as the possibility of the loss of future labor. The case of Sarah Carnell cast into doubt the industrialist assertion that women would be safe in the factories as they were working at home with their families. And here it was showing, not so much. It was therefore in the interest of the factory owners to keep Carnell from being smeared in the press and to push for the arrest and conviction of her murderer. Conversely, the Methodist Church wanted to earn respectability and make converts, and they wanted to avoid at all cost a criminal and sexual scandal involving not only one of their members, but a minister of their organization to boot. Both groups put a lot of money and efforts into both sides of the spectacle. The trial itself began November 6, 1833, and was heard by the Supreme Judicial Council, which is what they call Rhode Island Supreme Court today. Lawyers for the state were Rhode Island attorney Albert C. Green and former Attorney General Dante Pierce. Six lawyers had been hired for the defense and all paid for by the Methodist Church, directed by former United States Senator and New Hampshire Attorney General Jeremiah Mason. The trial ended up lasting 27 days. Under Rhode Island law in 1833, defendants in capital cases or murder trials were not permitted to offer testimony in their own defense. Avery did not get the opportunity to speak. However, both sides called many witnesses to testify, 68 for the prosecution, while the defense called 128 different witnesses. Although Jeremiah Mason maintained that Avery had not been present when the murder occurred, the more significant part of the defense strategy was to call into question Sarah Carnell's morals and standards. The defense characterized her as utterly abandoned, unprincipled, undisciplined, as well as other unladylike verbs and adjectives. It brought many witnesses to testify to her promiscuity, suicidal ideation, and her mental instability. Much was made of how she had actually been cast out of the Methodist Church for fornication. Sarah had come from a relatively prosperous and prominent Connecticut family. Still, the family had hit trouble and hard times after her dad, a very successful businessman in the paper cutting industry, ended up taking off and leaving the entire family with nothing. Cornell went back and forth between factory work and a skilled employment she had as a seamstress. She acquired a reputation for petty theft and general bad character. She moved from town to town in New England, engaging in several affairs, and once even contracting an STD. The prosecution attempted to portray the Methodist Church and its clergy as a dangerous, almost a kind of secret society, willing to defend their ministers and the good name of their church at any cost whatsoever. Now just stop and think about this for a moment. Does it not kind of sound familiar? You know what it said about history. It goes around, comes around. The community was also outraged at the medical debacle and debate between both sides around whether the unborn child was conceived in August or not. Community standards made it difficult for this discussion to occur in an open courtroom, which complicated the issues a great deal. One of the female witnesses, who had been assisting with the preparation of the victim's body for burial, when questioned as to the state of the body, refused to answer, telling the judge, "I have never heard of such questions being asked of anyone." Well, the trial took place there in Rhode Island in March of 1833. The prosecuting attorney in his opening statement told the court and the jury as follows. "It will be proved to you that on the morning of December 21st, last, the body of Sarah Cornell was found dead, hanging from a stake near the haystack on the land of John Duffer, about a half mile from the village of Fall River. It will be proved to you that she left her boarding house in Fall River the evening before in good health, and for her in uncommonly good spirits. That from the circumstances attending the adjustment of the cord by which she hung, there is good reason to conclude that the hanging was not her own act, and that from the appearance of her neck and of the cord, there is sufficient grounds to conclude that she was first strangled and then subsequently hung to the stake. It will be proved also that the wounds and bruises which were found upon her body indicate a struggle having taken place before her death. The prosecution will present evidence that the accused, Mr. Avery, had a motive to commit the crime, and that his whereabouts on the night of the murder cannot be accounted for. The injuries could not have been inflicted by herself, and the disordered appearance of her hair, the hair comb being found broken at a distance from the place where she was hung, will be circumstances to indicate a struggle, and to satisfy you that she never owed her death to some other hand than her own. That question then occurs, who was the author of her death? If, gentlemen, we show you upon this point a previous intimacy between the prisoner and the deceased, and if the situation caused by him was such as might furnish him with indictments to commit the act, if on the day of the murder the local situation of the prisoner was such that she might have committed the deed, if on the afternoon of December 20th, a frigid day, he left home, if from Bristol Ferry at 2 o'clock p.m., as we trace him by the indirect route, if from Lawson's house near the bridge, we trace him by an indirect route to Fall River, If we give further evidence of violence from screams heard near the place where the body was found, if we thus bring the parties together and thus prove a murder committed, we submit to you that the prisoner at the bar must have been the author of this violence. Well, the opening statement was rather long and continues for several pages of court document. And the evidence being introduced into the case made the whole trial very long. The detailed minute-by-minute documentation of the various witnesses' statements is so considerable that the court records fill several large legal books, which you can actually find the doc. And the court records still exist, have been used in teaching lawyers, and have been used in law school education. Well, the first witness, of course, was the man who found the body. And he stated that as he was passing his team through a lot about 60 rods from his house. Oh yeah, a rod. Unit of measurement. A rod is about 16.5 feet, so in this case we're looking at 330 yards. He continued on with, "When I arrived close to the stackyard, I observed the body of a female hanging within the yard to a stake in the fence. I went to her and found her dead. The cord by which she hung was fastened to the stake about 6 inches from the top. The distance from the knot on the stake to the knot on the neck was less than 6 inches." And he continues with his very detailed description of what he found. But after all of the testimony from both sides and the evidence presented, on June 2nd, 1833, after deliberating for over 16 hours, the jury found Ephraim Kingsbury Avery not guilty. The minister was set free and he returned to his position in the Methodist Church. Public opinion didn't go the way that the verdict did. It kind of fell by the wayside, and it was felt by many people that Avery had been wrongfully acquitted. Rallies were called and put together. The effigies of Avery were hung and burned, and he was once almost lynched in Boston. A great deal of anger was also directed at the Methodist Church, too. To counter the tensions, the church's New England conference convened a trial that was chaired by a gentleman by the name of Wilbur Fisk, in which Avery was once more acquitted. This did nothing really, though, to improve the community sentiment on the situation and sentiment towards Avery or the church. Avery later ended up writing a book about the whole experience called The Correct, Complete, and Impartial Report of the Trial of the Reverend Ephraim K. Avery. The preacher also went on a speaking tour to validate himself in the eyes of the public in general. But for the most part, his attempts to resurrect his image were pretty unsuccessful. In 1836, Avery left the Methodist ministry and took his family first to Connecticut. Then they went on to upstate New York and later settling in the state of Ohio, where he farmed until his death on October 23rd, 1869. And he was buried in South Pittsfield Cemetery, Lorain County, Ohio. In contrast, Cornell's grave has been visited many times over the years by hundreds, if not thousands, of people, as if it was a shrine. Still, as time passed, the crowds slowly went away. Many forgot about the 30-year-old woman from Fall River and the significance her murder had on social history in the United States. Was this another one of those trials of the century? Could be. And I'm sure we'll have more trials of the century in the future. Well, that's it for our Shade of Blue for this weekend. I hope you found it interesting. Be sure to come back in 14 days for another Shade of Blue story. If you'd like to drop us a line, you can reach Victoria and me at felonfile@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. If you would like to check out our website, scottlunsfordauthor.com or felonfile.com, feel free to do so. You can also sign up for tweets on the Felon File Twitter page. Just search for Felon File Twitter page. And if you do, you'll get a heads up on upcoming podcasts and occasional other information that comes down the pike. So before we sign off and give the console back to Victoria here at the Scratch Ankle Recording Studio, remember, if you get the chance, do something nice for somebody. Step out of your way, a little bit out of your comfort zone, and help somebody out. It's really the right thing to do. And if more people did it, yeah, place would probably be a lot better than what we have it now. It really wouldn't hurt. In the meantime, though, also, remember to be safe and secure in the coming weeks. Come back for another Shade of Blue story, and we'll talk to y'all later. Victoria, you got it. Bye, y'all.
Before we go, a quick bonus insert here on the Felon File. The following took place on June 15, 2023, when the previous episode was being edited. It was decided that it was essential to include this for our listeners at the Felon File. On June 15th, a curtain went up on a most unusual stage. Previously hidden from the view of the audience was just one actor. The actor reclined before the audience. The man, Dwayne Owens' eyes were closed. His head was shaved, a white sheet pulled up to his chin. When asked if the man had any last words, his simple reply was no. After this answer, Florida executed Dwayne Owen by lethal injection inside a Florida state prison, 39 years after he savagely murdered a teenage babysitter and a single mother. In the audience sat Debbie Johnson to witness Owen's death. Johnson, the sister of Karen Slattery. Slattery was murdered by Owen in 1984 as the 14-year-old babysat two children in Delray Beach. Owen confessed to stabbing Karen and raping her, and 2 months later, he raped and killed Georgiana Warden of Boca Raton with a hammer while her two small children slept nearby. The Florida Supreme Court rejected Owen's most recent appeal last week, and the U.S. Supreme Court rejected it Wednesday. A defense psychologist testified earlier this month that Owen believes he absorbed the souls of his victims and that they still exist inside him. Prosecutors argued that while Owen has mental health issues, he knows the execution was punishment for his crimes. Owen was the fourth person executed in Florida this year. Almost 40 years on death row. Is this punishment itself? Is this a deterrent to keep others from committing murder? Is this justice? What do you think? Owens's last written statement, handwritten on the morning of his execution, reads:
Statement of Dwayne Owen number 101660. I have transcended space and time. I have seen the visions of the crow. My energy and particles will transform ad infinitum. I will live on. I am Tula 13.
This has been The Felon File, a discussion on law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and other parts of the world. For more information, you can go to felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. Here you can find links to Scott and Numb books and other information. You can also email us at felonfile@gmail.com. There are also t-shirts and mugs available. You can also buy us a cup of coffee, or help purchase some of the research material and expenses it takes to do Felon File. Click on the coffee image on the web page to do so. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. Have a good one.